noting that although some of you are indeed very, very much experts, many of you don't work on anything quite like this, and I especially encourage you, for those of you who don't work in this area, to ask me questions throughout. This talk could be given in, say, 45 minutes if I really flew through it, so there's lots of time for questions along the way. So this is based on some work I did with Daniel Bauman, Anatoly Dymarsky, Shama Kachru, Igor Klebanov, and then some ongoing work with my student Sovan Gandhi, and then building on this prior work. This is the prior work that has analogous results reported in works by people who are here. So the goal of the broad program is to come up with models of the very early universe that are really suitable for a time of precision cosmology. So this means models that are theoretically sound enough and computable enough that we can make real and honest contact with data. Concretely, what I'm going to be thinking about is mechanisms for inflation in string theory, trying to propose mechanisms. And to do that, there's really a first step. Once you just sit down and compute the inflaton action in a string and magnification. Right? That's what it would mean to have some model of inflation in string theory. And let me emphasize the derive here. I'm really going to try and tell you about how one can take steps from an actual derivation rather than a sort of a phenomenological model developed in string theory. Now, the example I'll be focusing on is that of D3 brain inflation, initiated by Fali and Tai and then developed in a rather long series of works. The reason that it's non-trivial, both in this model, but quite a bit more generally, in fact, in all models of inflation and string theory, the problem is common approximation schemes, our leading order tools for dimensional reduction, typically fail to incorporate the relevant effects of massive moduli. And so we need to learn how can we actually incorporate those effects. So how can we make the moduli massive and then integrate them out, incorporating their effects into the inflaton action. So how to do that? Well, there are a variety of approaches. I'll sketch some of the possibilities. But what I'll be pursuing today is to pick a scenario that admits a huge toolkit. Here, non-compact approximations and ADS-CFT are both applicable if what one is studying, the system in question, is D-brained probing a throat region, a work throat region. So I'll explain in detail both how these schemes fail and how these new methods can be used. So I'll briefly review what the problem is, explain the approach, and then if there's time, I'll talk about a possibly interesting implication that comes out of this analysis. Okay, so first, the problem. Inflation is sensitive to Planck scale physics. And by that, here I concretely mean that the inflationary Lagrangian receives contributions from Planck suppressed operators of dimension up to approximately sometimes 7, some cases even 8, certainly lower dimension than 6. But let me stress the Planck suppressed. So the point is that very generally we do expect contributions to the inflaton action for integrating out UV degrees of freedom. Let's stress, this comes from integrating out massive degrees of freedom to which the inflaton couples. So if there's any stuff in the UV theory to which the inflaton has some couplings, then you really ought to make sure that your low energy theory incorporates the effects of those couplings. Now, for inflation, it really matters all the way up to the Planck scale. Often in particle physics, you can worry about CEB suppressed stuff or sometimes gut scale suppressed stuff. For inflation, it's critical to pay attention to Planck mass degrees of freedom to which the inflaton couples. On the other hand, we certainly know that some new degrees of freedom must arise to complete gravity at or well below the Planck scale. In string theory, very well below the Planck scale. In general, not above the Planck scale. So there must be something new there, and we have to incorporate its effects. I think the simplest way of doing this is working in a theory of Planck scale degrees of freedom, namely something like string theory, so that's the approach I'll be taking. But let's illustrate what I mean by this Planck suppression. Suppose you have some putative inflaton potential V, and you have ignored a contribution which is secretly there, and that contribution is the inflaton squared times the potential over Planck squared. So that's some dimension 6 Planck suppressed operator. In general, if the inflaton doesn't enjoy some shift symmetry, phi goes to phi plus constant, then this term will be allowed. I mean, the potential is surely allowed by hypothesis. And usually a mass term will be allowed unless you have a shape. So this term can be there. If you take that term and plug it in and use the Friedman equation, you find that the contribution to the slow roll parameter eta, which is the inflaton mass in Hubble units, is 2. So inflation does not persist for a long time. So if you ignored the presence of this term, you would have been tricking yourself into thinking you could get prolonged inflation when in fact you get first general inflation. The point I want to stress here is that this is the familiar eta problem. It's sometimes mistakenly called the supergravity eta problem. That's completely wrong. It's a problem in field theory generally. It's a problem in any field theory in which there are Planck mass degrees of freedom. But we would say that applies to all theories that have a completion in some sort of quantum gravity. Note that the scale of inflation dropped out of this, and the range of the inflaton dropped out. So this isn't one of these arguments which you may have often heard, that inflation involves a Taylor expansion in powers of phi over n Planck. And for large powers, you know, phi over n Planck to some large number, this series is badly controlled. That's not what I'm saying here. This is just for a mass term. And even if the excursion of the inflaton during inflation is extremely small in Planck units, the contribution to eta is still 2. Even if the inflationary energy is TeV, the contribution to eta is still 2. So this is something that just does not become.
So I have to ask then, so you're saying, would that also apply in these large volume kind of cases that, where you have exponentials? Canonically normalized field, you know, the inverse radius expansion is an exponential.
Right. So as we discussed last time I was here, for four hours or so, I think it applies. And I would be very interested to work out how to understand how it does arise. I tend to think it will arise in those cases. But I know that you have arguments that it doesn't arise in such cases.
Yeah, so I'm trying to pin you down as to, at that time, I had a sense that you were agnostic, but now it sounds like you're taking a stance. So you think
what I was talking about, that was something very different. Yeah, so, back to the previous session. There was a different discussion then, right? Okay. One of the things that was being talked about then was large field radius. And there, I admit, there could be a very interesting and different issue if you have a different kinetic term. Here, I'm just talking about a mass term. So I don't actually understand the difference.
But kind of implicitly, the phi here is canonically normalized phi, right?
Absolutely.
And so if the natural expansion variable was not phi, but it was...
I'm not expanding anything. I'm just saying if I had ignored a term like this, then I would have a problem. Or you could talk about it another way. So the other issue of large field ranges is different from this one, because here I'm just saying that the mass of the inflaton being small compared to Hubble is not radiatively stable, because Hubble is... at or below your cutoff.
Right.
So that statement, I think, is robust. One could come up with a symmetry argument. You could be able to formulate the large volume discussion in terms of a symmetry argument, but it would be equivalent to protecting the mass of a field and keeping the scalar well below the cutoff. So, I mean, you could do it, but it would be a hierarchy solution.
But in the sense that the thing that you're expanding your action in could be a complicated function of the canonically normalized variable.
If you can't solve the Higgs hierarchy problem with such an argument, or if you could, it would have to be reformulatable in terms of something that we would, I would say, all understand about why the mass does not get normalized out of the cutoff. So that's why I'm drawing a distinction between this argument, which is just that the inflaton mass ought to run up to its cutoff, and its cutoff can't be any lower than h,
right,
from the other argument which I previously made, which we should talk about offline, about large field ranges, which will play a role.
Okay. So you're still agnostic, I would read that as saying.
I'm not agnostic. Large field ranges will play no role in the discussion. I'm only talking about small field models and the eta problem in small field models. But I think this statement is, the presence of this operator is very generic. I already stated, I think, the only condition under which it can be absent, which is if there's a shift symmetry protecting phi. So I could believe you if you came up with a way of writing down some sort of novel dimensional reduction that had a shift symmetry protecting phi. That would forbid this term, I'd be happy. But without that, I wouldn't believe that this term is absent. I would say it had just been overlooked somewhere, and one would have to find it.
But if phi equals zero was a higher dimensional field theory, say, so there's degrees of freedom that were new in the problem in that expansion, so phi wouldn't be capturing the expansion, that's the kind of loophole that you would accept.
I would have to see the loophole. I think I stated the only way that I would accept it, which is that if it can be formulated in a four-dimensional description as a shift symmetry, I'm fine. Namely, that's falling into this point, which is, the inflaton doesn't couple to these high scale degrees of freedom.
No, I'm identifying an assumption. What you said is that you're assuming that phi equals zero has a four-dimensional expansion, which may not be true.
And I'm not expanding anything.
Well, you are, effectively, when you're saying that's a mass, what you're really doing is saying there's a vacuum and you're near a vacuum. that vacuum was describable by four-dimensional theory?
It doesn't have to be a vacuum. It could just be the place where it must be computing curvature around some place which isn't a vacuum, which is on some slope.
Yeah, so I don't mean vacuum in the sense of a minimum, right? Like it's like applying an inflation figure. When you're, I can see we can go offline here, but it's so if the limit where that your flatness was getting better and better and better was actually a six-dimensional or a higher-dimensional theory, then the symmetry you're looking for needn't be a four-dimensional shift symmetry. You can accept that roughly. So we should go offline as to whether or not specific examples do that. But it's, would you recognize that four-dimensional shift symmetries assume that the problem is a four-dimensional problem the way you're...
The way I'm formulating it is that the scale Hubble here is the usual Hubble scale in the four-dimensional theory, and the cutoff of the four-dimensional theory is at or above Hubble. So at Hubble and below, it's a four-dimensional problem. So that's the
assumption. Can I rephrase this? Maybe I would consider you give me the potential V. And since it's at the non-zero vacuum energy, and then there's a thermal effect, and this thermal effect is essentially the thing called the decentered horizon, that's a given Hawking temperature. And you can use thermal finite field theory to calculate a term which is exactly like this, with a coefficient, I don't remember, 12 or something. So if you treat the field theory and say because of the decentered horizon, such a term will automatically arise unless you have a symmetry to prevent.
That statement I'm happy with, but I'm interested in the limit where the limit you're focusing on is a weakly coupled limit. So you're thinking of the thermal corruption that you're talking about as being an ultraviolet effect. The kind of counter terms that they would generate are constrained by higher dimensional general covariance that you would miss if you were doing it in a four dimensional framework.
What's missing if I just throw down a cutoff at or above h and analyze it four-dimensionally, either the way Henry's describing or this way. What's missing?
Well, we'll be missing in the four-dimensional, if you're thinking of a weak curvature limit where the thing that's controlling your flatness is the weak curvature, then in the limit, the hard limit where you take that to zero, you're actually not in the four-dimensional theory. So there's degrees of freedom that are coming down, and so this whole, the whole organization of the
well, I mean, you're describing, I would say, a reasonably exotic example. We could argue about whether it's not realized or something.
I understand.
I know, as we've discussed for many hours last time. So let me know and not discuss this particular point in the remainder of the talk. Right. And we can spend the rest of the conference on it.
Okay. So the takeaway message for me is that you think you're starting to apply to that concrete example that I have.
Yes. I think as long as what you're talking about has a valid four-dimensional description during the inflationary stage, namely at or below Hubble, and the inflaton, then if the inflaton has some coupling to the high scale degrees of freedom, namely if it does not have a shift symmetry, then I think this problem will apply. So I'm willing to accept arguments that either the theory isn't four-dimensional or it has a shift symmetry. Mm-hmm. And I won't now agree to other kinds of arguments, but maybe you can persuade me. But I think you're arguing that maybe higher dimensional effectively. And that sort of argument I can accept.
It's a combination of that and the shift symmetry could be possible.
Right. So given some combination of higher dimensionality and shift symmetry, however, this is a statement about. Okay, so let me stress again. All I said I'm doing this in string theory. What do I mean by that? I mean I'm going to be dimensionally reducing string theory all the way down to four dimensions. Okay, so I'm going to get to four dimensions and then do the analysis. And what I'm going to tell you about is how do I compute the terms in the four-dimensional action? But there are always terms in a four-dimensional action. Okay, so, yes?
After all, don't you expect an approximate shift symmetry always for the inflaton? Because you want the inflaton to be very, very careful, right? Okay? So,
it depends on how strong your stimuli. Depends on what you mean by approximate shift symmetry. If you mean eta and epsilon will be arranged to be small by some fine tuning, sure. No, that's by construction.
No, I'm saying that if indeed you have only small couplings, the term you are postulating, the extra term there, will be suppressed, in fact, by additional powers of those couplings.
Sure. If you write down some sort of seemingly good V and then try and normalize, then this problem does not arise. Okay. What I'm saying is that if that happens to you, then you've done something a little bit better. It means that in your high-scale theory, you've managed to prevent the inflaton from coupling to anything that has a Planck scale mass at the order one level. So in string theory, it's very delicate to arrange that does arise. So I'm actually saying that it's a little bit hard to get to the situation that you postulate, where you're in a four-dimensional Euclidean theory with some V that has only weak couplings. That's actually hard to get to because you have to integrate out so many massive moduli. The moduli are not too massive, and so they tend to introduce large couplings there, and that's why the problem comes up. So actually, if one thinks about it from the ground up, it actually doesn't even seem, I would say, that generic that this problem will be present. What we find is that in essentially every string theory case, it does arise for the reason that there's lots of stuff at the Planck scale, and there's no good reason that we've found, barring some special set of shift symmetry, for the infotron not to couple to that Planck slot.
So there is always, he's saying, some coupling over there as well, but you're saying it's actually very big.
So the couplings of the infotron to itself could be small. In the final result, when you've succeeded, the infotron, you'll have an effective theory in which the infotron will have weak couplings. Everything will look good. The four-dimensional description will be just fine. You try and normalize it, it looks fine. What I'm saying is that what you're starting with is a theory with, let's say, hundreds of fields. The infotron is one of those fields. In general, it has some amount of couplings to most of the other fields. You have to integrate out all the other fields, 99 of them or something like this. Their masses are well below the Planck scale. Even if they were Planck scale, if it had order one couplings to them, they would cause this problem. Since these fields you're integrating out are so much lighter than the Planck scale, even much less than order one couplings would be a problem. So you have to worry about what happens when you integrate out all that stuff. And the claim is the result is generically not an inflationary theory with a flat potential and weak couplings. However, that's the goal, is to get there. So I want to explain to you how you can deal with this problem. Okay, so you basically got two options. One of them is to invoke a shift symmetry. This is a very sensible option. I've actually spoken about it here before, and we had, in fact, the same discussion the last time. So let's pass on from this point. This is, by the way, a very selected list of examples. This is the classic work, and then here are some examples in string theory that try to realize this kind of shift symmetry. The other thing you could try and do is try and figure out all the relevant contributions and balance them off against each other. You know, they're normally going up to dimension 6, so let me just write down all the dimension 6 operators in my theory and try and play them off against each other. This effectively means that I'm, at the start, proposing something which will end up being fine. Okay, this is not going to be natural. These models can be natural. However, one side comment, it's not actually been particularly easy to implement this in string theory. The idea has been clear for a long time. Not many shift symmetries that are potent enough are present. The reason being, what I was just saying on the previous slide is that there's a lot of stuff in the Planck scale. And you have to have a shift symmetry that's incredibly powerful. It has to keep you from coupling to any of it. That's hard to do. It's been rarely achieved. So let's talk about just enumerating contributions and balancing them up against each other. So a few words about how do these effects really arise in the string theory. You know, so far I've spoken a little bit about the field theory realization of these contributions. In string inflation, they take various forms. They come from string loop corrections, alpha prime corrections, non-perturbative effects of various sorts, some of which I'll come back and talk about. But you should really think about them as mostly coming from integrating out massive moduli. So why are they moduli? Because a string magnification has a very large number of deformations in general, some geometric deformations, some non-geometric deformations. And if you didn't stabilize them, if those fields remained massless, you would have a disaster cosmologically. You'd have to spoil DBN. You'd overclose the universe. So you have to stabilize them. You have to give those moduli a mass. But you're not going to be able to give them a mass that's bigger than n Planck. In general, the mass will be a great deal smaller than n Planck. So you should integrate them out carefully, incorporating their couplings to the infotron.
And do you agree that some of those couplings can be weaker than Planck suppressed?
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely right. That's what one would look for. I mean, one would be very happy finding a situation where the inflaton couples more than Planck suppression to basically everything, which is surely the kind of thing that you have in mind.
What I have in mind is in the large volume models, like the complex structure and the scalar moduli, if your volume stress in addition to
Planck stress. Right. Yeah, it's actually slightly subtle to relate the degree of suppression here to the degree of suppression seen there. But the lesson from most concrete examples where the comparison has been made is that the field theory estimate comes out basically spot on within a factor of a few. So it's of course of interest to find cases where this does not occur. So what I'm going to do is tell you how can you really, so if you want to know the inflaton potential, you really have to do this. You have to integrate out the massive muscle. So this is a pain, but we'd better do it. So why can I persuade you to pay attention to this kind of thing? I think the only really good argument for this is that there's a lot of promise in using cosmology and string theory together, using the sensitivity to Planck scale physics as a probe, effectively and eventually an experimental probe of laws of nature at very high energies. And to accomplish that, to really use inflation to probe Planck scale physics in any kind of indirect way, one really has to do the thing that I was describing rather than construct phenomenological models of inflation in string theory. Because the phenomenological models have value in themselves, but what they can't do is really start to probe this high-scale stuff. This stuff only comes out when you really jump in and start fighting with the kinds of contributions that string theory provides. So we should just study one or more models for long enough to get everything right. So for D3-brain inflation, I'll tell you, if there's enough time, I'll tell you how to compute the potential three different ways. And then even if you doubt any one of the calculations, surely you'll believe me at the end because I'll get the same answer. So what I'm going to do is compute the potential for a D3 ring in a compact Plevanov-Strassler probe attached to a general bulk. And the key issue is that the moduli, the Taylor moduli of the bulk, are going to be assumed to be stabilized non-perturbatively. So the scenario I have in mind is the following. Consider a warp throw region. So this is like a Randall syndrome picture with the infrared brain here and the Planck brain here. But this is a warp throw, which is a cone over some 5 manifold. Here's the deep infrared, the radial coordinate extends from r equals 0 up to large r. And it's glued into some compact space, which I'll assume is an orientable of the Kaladia threefold. And the compact space is assumed to be stabilized by fluxes, three-form fluxes, and by a non-perturbative superposition. So when the time comes, I'll tell you more about the non-perturbative superposition. Then the story one would like to tell is that a D3 brain sits here in the throat, an anti-D3 brain sits there at the bottom, and under the influence of the weak Coulomb interaction between them, because they have opposite charges, the D3 drifts toward the anti-D3, and in the process drives inflation. The interaction is weak, so the idea would be that they drive prolonged inflation with a flat. So this is the story you'd like to tell, but it's far from the right story. This is just the starting idea. The problem is this. This compact space creates a huge effect on the D3 brain potential. And that's what we've got to figure out. So let's just ask, what's the potential? I've removed the anti-D3 brain. Let's just ask, if I take a D3 brain in a throat attached to a stabilized bulk, does it feel a potential or not? So specifically, I'm going to be looking for the leading effect. Namely, if I expand the potential and keep the most important term, that's the one I'll talk about. The rest of the terms are in our papers, but I won't bother you with them. So we're going to start by setting notation. Consider a flux compactification like this. Here I've written a space-time metric. This is 3 plus 1 dimensional. And an internal space, g tilde, which can be a Kaladia metric, although it won't matter much. And then connecting them is this warp factor, e to the a. A is a function of the y's, which are the coordinates of the internal space. So the space-time slices are warped over the Kaladia space. I've also written an ansatz for the 5-form field strength, which is given by d of some function, alpha. Alpha is just a function on the internal space. So alpha will be then associated with the Ramon 4-form potential, C4. So in terms of these data, the potential for a D3 brain actually is pretty straightforward to write down. I'm going to define this one symbol, phi minus, which is e to the 4a, or e to the a, minus alpha. And that's the difference of some warping and a 4-form contribution. The D3 brain potential is given by the Bornfeld plus Trinsheim's action. So this part tells you about the warping along the space-time directions extended, or along which the brain is extended. And alpha tells you about the coupling of the D3 brain to C4. Okay, so this is some 10-dimensional scalar field that represents the D3 brain potential. And we'd like to know, what is it? You know, what's the background? What's the solution for phi minus? Okay, is it quite clear why I want to study phi minus? Because this will be most of the remainder, in fact, of the drug. Okay. So I've also written the fluxes G plus and minus, which are the self-dual and anti-self-dual three-form fluxes. And there's a class of solutions which are imaginary self-dual. Here I'm using language a little bit to let imaginary self-dual also apply to this scalar. And ISD solutions for the purposes of this talk will be those in which G minus and phi minus. So in such solutions, well, you can see that the potential for a D-free ring vanishes. It vanishes no matter where the D-free ring is. You can put the D-free ring anywhere you like in the compact space, its potential will be zero. Okay, but that is going to be spoiled by non-perturbative stabilization of the Kalar moduli, and then that's the task of this talk. So let's talk briefly about non-perturbative stabilization of the Kalar moduli. A KPLT compactification can be described more or less phenomenologically by this kind of n equals 1 data. A superpotential coming from fluxes, so this is a 3-0 term of the Kalabiya, this is a free-form flux, and a non-perturbative term. The prefactor A of Y will be pretty important for us. Right now you can think of this as being a Gaugino condensate superpotential, and this a threshold prefactor, from a threshold correction to the gauge couple. Rho is the Kalar modulus. Let's assume there's just one overall Kalar modulus, so H11 equals 1. Little a is a constant, that won't matter. And the Kalar potential A here, given in the no-scale form, involving the Kalar modulus and the D3 ring field Y. So Y is a coordinate on the internal space, and little k here is the Kalar potential for the metric on the D3 ring moduli space. Okay, so this is the Kalar potential for the moduli space metric overall. This is the Kalar potential for the Kalabiya metric. Now, in the caricature down there, I've shown you some wrapped brains. These little lines are supposed to represent D7 brains wrapping 4 cycles. When D7 rings wrap suitable 4 cycles, then Gaugino condensation can occur in the 4-dimensional theory, and the Gaugino condensate superpotential takes this point. Okay, so in brief, the proposal of KPLT is D7 ring stacks wrapping 4 cycles generate a Gaugino condensate superpotential here, and the result is stabilization of the module. Okay, so if you're given n equals 1 data like this, your first step would be to try and find supersymmetric solutions, try and find F-flat solutions. So the fields I've given you here are rho and y, so let's solve that the Kalar covariant derivatives of the superpotential with respect to rho and y vanish. You can easily see that if a of y here is some generic function, then those solutions are isolated. What that means is if you try and put a D3 ring somewhere in a stabilized Kalabiya, it's only going to be supersymmetric at an isolated set of points, but not at general locations. And between those supersymmetric points, those D3 ring vacuum, it will experience a potential. So what we need to do is figure out what's the potential. Because if we're going to inflate, we need to move some distance. And so we need to know the potential off those locations. So to get that, well, the unspecified data here is this prefactor A of Y. So somehow I need to effectively communicate that data to this low, into this low energy theory. Okay, questions so far? Okay. Basically, we have two choices. One of them is to compute A of Y in some special case. If there's time, I'll get back to that at the end. But a more, I would say, amusing approach, and ultimately satisfying because it gives you a much broader structure, is to try and characterize the structure of the potential more generally. So we'll start out studying the structure of the potential pretty generally, and then come back and check and make sure that the different approaches actually agree. Now, it's not going to be easy to compute this in total generality. I mean, if you think about it, we don't even know the metric up here, because that would be a Kalabiya metric. So we're not going to be able to get all the data about the potential, even about the kinetic terms for the system everywhere. But what can we do? Well, the idea is if you take a D3 ring that's well inside a workflow, right, far from this top region, then the leading effects are going to be captured by the structure of the throat and some information about the boundary conditions in the ultraviolet. Namely, if you're far away from this stuff here, you don't need to know everything about it. You need to know some restricted bit of information about it. So this is actually pretty intuitive in the conformal field theory that's dual to this throat. I'll come back to that in a little bit. So let's just work on the gravity side first, before coming back to the conformal field theory description. The potential in Tenti supergravity, well, I've given you the data of Tenti supergravity. I just need to compute the profile of the scalar field phi minus. Now, the idea is that arbitrary compactification effects, all this stuff in the compact ball, can be represented by specifying boundary conditions for phi minus in the ultraviolet region of the throat, i.e. by allowing arbitrary non-normalizable phi minus profiles. So non-normalizable means increasing for the ultraviolet, okay, growing modes. So the picture is something like this. You take all of the terrible things happening in the compact part of the colonia and you just throw them into the throat and see what you get far down. See what the leading effect is in the deep infrared. So why is this effective? I mean, why do you not need to know all of the data of this chunk? There's a filtering effect coming from the renormalization group flow. Okay, and the effect is as follows. The warp geometry takes contributions in the far ultraviolet and reduces them in the infrared, like so, as powers of, if you measure the potential at some scale lambda, then the potential will look like some series in lambda over the ultraviolet scale to the power of the anomalous dimension, delta I. So as you move down the energy scale, this series reasserts itself, and the more and more relevant terms become more and more important, as you will feel. So the leading contributions in the deep infrared are those that are diminishing least rapidly, namely the most relevant operators in the gauge theory. So if you just knew the most relevant operators in the gauge theory, you could say, well, it doesn't matter what horrible things you do here, only a subset of those effects can possibly filter their way down to the infrared. So the structure of the potential here, the powers delta I, is then given by the anomalous dimensions of the various operators in the CFT that is dual to this warp throat region. I've added one more thing here. I've added some dependence on some angles. So remember, this throat is a cone over some phi manifold. So I'll just represent the five angles by psi. They won't be very important, but in principle, you should remember that each of these terms in the sum has some different angular dependence. So you're adding them all together. Moreover, there are some coefficients, ci. I mean, you might call them Wilson coefficients, I suppose. I'm not going to propose to compute them. In the papers that I cited, we effectively show that once you know the structure of the potential but don't know the ci's, you can actually learn an awful lot. And you can do without knowing them to a certain extent. On the other hand, I'll also give you an explicit example where I do compute them. But in this talk, let's just imagine what I'm going after is these powers delta I. Because when I know that, I know what the potential is going to look like. Right? Is the strategy quite clear? Okay, so how do we do it? Well, let's just do this on the gravity side. We're going to consider linearized perturbations of this scalar field around a finite length throat. I'm going to approximate the throat by ADS5 times T1. So T11 is a coset space, SQ2 times SQ2 minus V1. Topologically, it's a two-sphere times a three-sphere. But all we really need to pay attention to is the radial thing here. So just the RS-like part, and leave this part away. And here, there's a warp factor, which depends on R. Now, in terms of this information, I should take this kind of background and linearize the equations of motion around it. So here, I just reproduced, for your convenience, the notations I introduced before. And in terms of these data, the Einstein equation and the Ampere theory give you the following equation of motion. It's just that's like a Laplace equation for this field phi minus that has some nonlinear source and is also a source term coming from the imaginary anti-self dual flux. But luckily, we don't need to deal with the full thing. We're trying to linearize, right? So this is linear order in the perturbation. This is quadratic, so let's drop the phi minus first. Now, what we've got left is this fellow. And if in this solution, G minus, the imaginary anti-self dual flux, were vanishing, then we'd just be solving the Laplace equation in the conical, namely in a cone over T11. And it will be a useful world to do that first, okay? Because it's much easier to solve the Laplace equation. Let me caution you that actually the leading term in the potential will come from including a non-trivial right-hand side here. But as usual, let's just solve the homogeneous equation first and then go back to the inhomogeneous. So what we'd like to do is solve the Laplace equation in the conical. And we're not going to need the full data of the angular dependence. So I'm going to write out the answer for you. I hope it's intuitive that since the conical is a cone over some angular manifold, the solutions are separable like this. They have powers of r and then some angular eigenfunctions. Here, psi represents all the angles on the cone, on the conical rather. R is the radial coordinate. These are just coefficients. And the angular eigenfunctions ylm are eigenfunctions of the Laplacian on T11 rather than the six-dimensional Laplacian. Now, what are these L's and M's? Well, the space T11 is a coset space with isometry SU2 times SU2 times U1. And so L represents the two SU2 angular momenta and the R charge, and M represents the magnetic moments. Now, after this slide and the next, this data is not going to be important. I've put it up here now just so you can see that these quantities, delta L, can be computed, and they can be computed explicitly in terms of the angular quantum numbers. So once I know what the allowed values of the angular quantum numbers are, I can just plug it into this result and get the structure of the potential. Okay, so it's as easy as that, really. I mean, I can just take from these people this result for delta, and I can read off the structure.
Sorry, what was R?
R is the radial coordinate in the throat.
So it's an integer, or what is
it? It's
capital. I'm sorry. No, it's the R charge. It can be half integer.
Okay.
So it's just a U1 quantum. It's a U1 charge.
Okay.
Okay. Does that answer?
Okay.
Yep. Okay. So. Remember, we're trying to find the structure of the potential, so we want to know the lowest nodes, the most relevant terms. So all we do is just go through the list of allowed quantum numbers and plug into the formula for the dimension delta. And one finds the following. The lowest mode has J1 equals J2 equals 1/2 and R equals 1. And that mode has dimension 3/2, so it gives rise to this term. And then the next thing you can find has quantum numbers 1, 0, 0 or 1, 0, 1, I mean 0, 1, 0. And this fellow has dimension 2. So our result is just that the structure of the potential is R to the 3/2 plus R squared plus delta dot. So that was pretty easy. But we should check, right? Because what we did is ignore this right-hand side. I assumed there wasn't any G minus turned on, and I solved the little plus equation. Well, let me solve the plus equation. And how do you do that? Well, you turn on a general background for this field G. Plug it in and solve again. You certainly don't need to see the details. I will skip over all of it. Because what we are after is just, well, what's the leading term that comes out when you do this? If you turn on some general profile of G minus, you know, there's some leading term, some most important term in the infrared. And you'd like to ask, does that most important term have some effect on the solution for phi minus? The answer is yes. You get a linear term. Maybe it's like R over 1. So that's actually more important than the terms that I've had so far. So it's the dominant term.
That depends on the lambdas.
Correct. So the lambdas, what I've suppressed here is that you can do for G minus what I showed you for the scalars. Namely, you can find the modes. Okay. I should put some C sub lambda here, and all I assumed for this is that the coefficient for the lowest lambda is non-zero.
What is the lowest lambda?
The lowest lambda is 5/2.
5/2. Why?
Well, what you have to do is take this, so this is some anti-symmetric, effectively the thing that one should solve for is the spectrum of an anti-symmetric tensor, two-index anti-symmetric tensor, it turns out, because it's just the potential for this guy in the console. And so that obeys some equation of motion. Solve that equation of motion, find the lowest modes, in exactly analogous way to what I did here for the phi minus, which was obeying this equation of motion. Okay, so do the same thing, but now since it's a tensor equation of motion, I don't want to show you all the junk. Okay, but the same thing happens. You get some data like this. Lambda is equal to some bunch of stuff depending on the angular quantum numbers. So I suppress that, and I even suppress what lambda is, and just tell you, if you turn on the lowest one, the most important one, then what it does is contribute a linear term. Okay, is that clear? I mean, I could say a little bit more about it, but I feel like it's probably not... Well, if that point itself is clear, then the computation won't be instructive.
If you did the subdominant term, the second subdominant term in G, would that still dominate the R squared, or is it something?
No, it'd be R squared. You can't get R to the 3/2. The next thing you get from this guy is R squared. Okay, so putting it together, what you got is a potential that looks like this. If you solve this equation of motion for the scalar field in a general background, then the determinant potential looks like so. And if you put those terms together, you see one finds that you can fine-tune them to get an inflection point kind of structure in the potential. Now, let me say that, so what we're doing is throwing all manner of junk into the ultraviolet region of the throat, and the lesson of this is that the junction has to come in two sorts. We need to turn on phi minus in the ultraviolet region. That's for these terms, for the homogeneous enriching. And we also had better turn on g minus, right, because that sources this function. Now, one question you could ask is, well, look, all I've done so far is find the most general potential that has leading terms. But you could ask, how do I know that that potential is actually activated? I mean, why are these terms actually turned on? Why are there non-zero coefficients for these various modes? This is a perfectly fair question. To get there, I want to analyze this in another way, and I'll avoid that every time, perhaps even in a third way, which will eventually convince you, I hope, that actually these terms should generically be present. I think all of, I've convinced you here, I hope, that these terms can be present, but let's see if they are. So another way of analyzing this, let's switch gears and go to the dual gauge theory. So over there, this is the gauge theory that's dual by ADS-CFT to the warped Freud region. And in the gauge theory, the normalizable perturbations, namely the perturbations that are localized in the infrared, correspond to perturbations of the state of the dual conformal field. These are IR contributions. They're localized, let's say, at the tip of the throat. And they typically decouple from all of this bulk trouble that's going on. They're not related to moduli stabilization. They're well localized. They're easy to study. So I won't study them here. They've been studied in prior works. However, the non-normalizable perturbations here, which grow with R, correspond to perturbations of the Lagrangian of the CFT, adding some new operator to your Lagrangian. These are UV contributions. As UV contributions, they originate in the ultraviolet region of the throat. They're coming from the compact part of the space, so they know all about the moduli stabilization, et cetera. And these are the terms I had better keep. So let me focus on these. I hope it's clear by analogy to the gravity case where I was studying only the growing mode solution for the like positive powers of R. Here, too, I'm studying the growing mode solution. Now, arbitrary magnification effects can be then incorporated by including arbitrary perturbations of the Lagrangian V and running down to the infrared. So how do you write that? Here's an expression in terms of n equals 1 superspace. The Lagrangian, the zero-order Lagrangian L0 are added to some correction term, which involves a correction to the Gettler potential and some correction to the superpotential. In general, these corrections to the superpotential and Gettler potential should just be sums over various operators allowed in theory times coefficients. For the simplest case, you should think that these operators are made out of the degrees of freedom of the CFT. In the case of the superpotential, because there's only a d2 theta integral, they better be chiral, not involving antichiral fields. For the Gettler potential, they better be able to soak up a d2 theta with d2 theta r. Now, that's at the leading level. The next level of complexity is you might say, well, these operators could actually involve four-dimensional curvature invariants or hidden sector fields. Because really what we want to do is take a four-dimensional conformal field theory and couple it to two things, four-dimensional gravity and a bulk that has lots of stuff going on. So a very complicated hidden sector. We better be, allow ourselves to make these operators out of hidden sectors. Now, the RG flow filters these effects, as we've already discussed. And so the structure is determined by the most, by the lowest dimension operators. But now we see the analysis is a little different. On the gravity side, we had to just solve some Laplace equation and find the lowest few bounds. On the CFT side, well, we know the degrees of freedom of the CFT, so we can just build up operators and find which ones are lowest dimension. So I'll just tell you the field content of the CFT, and you'll easily be able to see what the lowest dimension operator is. The superconformal field theory dual to the throw region I'm talking about is the Klebanov-Witten conformal field theory. It has a gauge group SUN times SUN with some bifundamental fields AB in the NN bar and N bar N. And just like this five-manifold T11, it has isometry, well, it has global symmetry, SE2 times SE2 times 1. These indices I here are doublets of the SE2s. Now, if you think about it for a little bit, you'll see that the lowest dimension gauge invariant you can make out of these fields A and B is an A times a B traced over the gauge. Now, the anomalous dimensions of these fellows one can compute to be 3/4. So if you make something out of an A and a B, it has dimension 3/2. So the lowest dimension operator in the theory is a chiral operator made of an A and a B, it's gauge invariant, and it's got dimension 3/2. Here, I mean, you could add more A's and more B's, and then the dimension would be larger and larger, 3/2 K, if you have K pairs of A's and B's. So then let's just plug this in. You could just try and take this thing O3 halves. So O3 halves is this operator trace in B. Sorry, same notation. Bad notation here. Same thing. You can try and add it to the superpotential or to the Kalor potential. Now, if you add it to the Kalor potential, it can't soak up the D4 theta integral, right? Because it only contains thetas in its superpotential potential. So what you better add to it is some sort of spurion for hidden sector Susie breaking, some X dagger or something. So you could do that, and this is discussed in our papers, but the most important thing to do, and the most relevant contribution, is to just take this thing O3 halves and put it in the superpotential like that. So all I'm doing is starting with the Klebanoff-Witten superconformal field theory and perturbing it by a superpotential term, like this. And the superpotential term is by a dimension 3 max operator. Great, so if you just take that and plug it in and compute the potential on the Coulomb branch of this theory, you find the potential goes like R of the 1. So it's just like what I said before. Now, remember, the R of the 1 term came from flux as a source, so somehow turning on the superpotential term corresponds to turning on flux. Okay, so now we've seen this two ways, right? We've solved the bulk equation of motion, first this scalar field, and gotten a potential, and got the same potential from perturbing the dual CFT. The last thing you can try and do is just compute this quantity A of Y that appears here in this n equals 1 data about KPLP for magnification. And plug it in to, if you compute A of Y and plug it in, well, once you know W and K, you can use usual formula in supergravity to find the potential. And so if you found the potential there, well, just compare it to what is potential. Any questions?
So in the beginning, you argued that you need some unnatural weak coupling to heavy physics to heavy friction, essentially. So do you then see a similar fine-tuning in heavy physics?
Yeah, I do. So the way of describing what happens here would be this. When I got from there to there, I was fine-tuning parameters. Okay. So what I did is I would basically take, so to the extent that I'm well in the UV, well in the infrared, terms with higher powers of R are negligible by powers of warping. So the potential is well described by this, but the data, the potential is then given by C1, C3, half, C2. And what you have to do is balance them against each other to some percent precision, and then you get an inflationary effect.
So it's a similar fine tuning that you see in the thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, what you can arrange to see where these things come from in UV theory, but it doesn't change the degree of tuning. There's no miracle, either positive or negative, making the tuning look much better or worse. Any other questions? I mean, if you ask me enough questions, I won't even just compute it. If you believe me already, I can just not compute this a third way.
We believe you. Who believes
me? So, okay, how can you do it? I'm just going to call it.
So, you mentioned that initially that you can compute these sheets in principle.
Yeah.
So, but now you now treat them as basically arbitrary.
Right, good. So there are these sort of two approaches. Here, the approach is, you might say, structural. Find the structure of the potential, but don't compute the seeds. And then here, by comparing to an explicit example, I can find a case where I can actually get some of the data out of the seeds. So perhaps then I should say how it is that I compute this AYC. If I compute this AY in detail, then I know the whole potential. And what I can do is match that to here and see So I'll compute a potential here. I expand that potential in powers of R, and then I'll see, as a result, what the various coefficients are. Okay. It won't be complete. What one really wants to do is put all of these things together. But let me show you how I can sort of get some of the data that seeds out. So what can you do? I mean, remember that the physics responsible for this whole trouble is moduli stabilization. And in particular, it's non-perturbative moduli stabilization. Non-perturbative moduli stabilization is supported on four cycles, where, let's say, a stack of D7 grains carries a genocompensation. In general, those things are hiding back here in the bulk. And then the best you can do is smear this out and understand what the potential could possibly look like down here. But let's say we're lucky. If you're lucky, maybe one of the four cycles in question protrudes a little bit into the throat region. When it's in the throat, you actually have an explicit metric. I can write down the metric for the deformed monofold, which is given by this algebraic equation in four complex variables. And I can even write some algebraic equation, let's say, Z1 equals constant, defining this force. So everything's explicit, and I can just try and do the computation. So that's the idea. This wouldn't give me the answer for all cases. It'll give me the answer for all those cases in which I'm lucky enough that the leading effect comes from a 7 brain that's been kind enough to enter into my coordinate patch and leave the region where I can't write down an echo. This can happen. It certainly happens. Now, why is there an effect? Why do D3 brains care about these non-recursive effects? So you know that if you have enough D3 brains in flat space, you get an ADS5 plus S5 probe. So if you have one D3 brain sitting here, drawn big to show that it's having an effect, it warps the space. That little bit of warping propagates up to here, to where the D7 brain is sitting. Now what I've written down here is that the non-perturbative superpotential is given by the exponential of the volume of this four cycle. But in fact, it's the warp volume that matters. So you can see from that that the, so here, VW sigma 4 means the warp volume of the four cycle sigma 4. T3 is the D3 brain tension, which just sets the units. So you can see that since the D3 brain warps the background a little bit, it slightly corrects the warp volume of this four cycle. And hence it corrects the thing appearing in the exponent. So as a result, if you move the D3 brain around a little bit, you dramatically change the warp volume of the cycle. Hence you change the superpotential. You change the superpotential when you move the D3 brain, then the D3 brain must be more potential. So you can go ahead and compute this. I certainly won't show you the computation. But the result is pretty clean at the end. If the wrapped brains are embedded along a locus given by an equation like this, then the resulting superpotential is just has A equals the nth root of the embedding equation. So that's pretty simple. And let me state one possibly confusing thing. Up here, f of zi equals 0, that's a geometric equation specifying where these 7 brains are sitting. Here, I'm running the data of a four-dimensional theory. So you may rightly ask, why are these coordinates zi appearing in the four-dimensional theory? The reason is the four-dimensional theory has a D3 ring. The D3 ring moduli space is the Golgi app. So these are coordinates on the configuration space, the zi's. So this tells you, in particular, that the non-perturbative superpotential vanishes whenever the D3 ring sits off the D7 ring, because f equals 0 is the locus where the 7 ring is. You bring it onto the D7 ring, the back reaction of the D3 ring is huge, and the superpotential goes away. So what can you do with all this? Well, you can just take some explicit example like f equals z minus mu and, you know, turn the crank. Take the result I expressed for the superpotential, drop it into the data for a KPLT scenario, use the familiar supergravity formula and compute the potential, and you get the same potential I showed you before, the linear force 3/2 plus r squared. What you can do, so it would introduce far too much notation to show you now. You can explain what these C1, C3 halves, and C2 are in terms of assumptions about the compact space, you know, say the overall size, the string coupling, quantities like that. And you know, we gave in a 2007 paper, we gave explicit expressions for the dot bands. So that's the best you can do. However, one has to worry that there's going to be, in a general scenario, some admixture of the effects of a 7 ray that comes into the throat, plus more junk taking place in the log. In general, you want to know how to put them together, so one doesn't usually know. So to recap, we've understood
that. This last way of calculating relied on that thing, the one cycle dangling down into the throat, but the previous one is good.
They're effectively complementary. This one tells you about all of the stuff that comes from the throat region. And the previous stuff drew a curtain here and said, I will consider only the things that impinge on this from above there, but below this line, I assume throat being empty. So to say it again, in the first approach that I undertook, I drew basically general UV boundary conditions here. I let any kind of junk from the vault impinge on that upper region and propagate downward. So I'm finding a general solution with some general boundary conditions, but with no sources in the vault, like no separate. In the second approach, I take clean boundary conditions here with no junk impinging on it, and just a 7 ring. And what one in general want to do is combine them. You can combine them, but it's clear the structure will be the same.
But in particular, the coefficient C are not being, there's not a sense in which the, if I have something dangling in the throat, it dominates. It's contributing the same size as...
No, that can well be true, because in general, this far away stuff comes from 7 brains wrecking other cycles, so they're farther away. So depending on the geometry, you can try and argue that the nearest regions of the 7 brain are the most important regions of the 7 brain.
Right. And that would show up in these Cs, and the Cs would be suppressed by some number.
That's right. So then if I did the general approach using UV data and tried to compute the Cs there, I would, in general, you would expect it's something that would be quite small compared to the contribution of the 7 ray that came well into the throat. Okay. It's not particularly trivial to do the estimate. We've done the estimates. I'm not sure that they're right at this stage. So all I can say is it's good for us that the structure of the potential is the same both ways, because then we don't need to know yet. We can give ourselves a little time to compute the coefficients, which will amount to, as you say, figuring out whether 7 rays far away give large or small c's compared to the c's given by.
But you wanted to kind of address that other question about if you ask kind of in a real string calculation, can you compute something which gives the fine tuning you want, then you really would have to sort out together.
You need to sort it out, yeah, that's right. So there are certainly cases where they can be smaller. I don't have any good way of saying how generic that is. So, because in particular, this thing, you know, it has its own portions that are extending up just a little bit farther. So when there is a systematic expansion, the expansion is in powers of R, you know, R where you're measuring over R UV. But one needs to know how quickly that converges to something right. And I wouldn't say that we're really that confident about this. So we computed the potential three different ways. Yes, right.
No, I just said 5 minutes.
Yeah, oh, well, I'm about to So the phenomenology is that of inflection point inflation. Once you fine-tune, generically what you get is something like this, but you can arrange that these things balance against each other. And then what's shown here is that the spectrum is blue while the curvature is positive and red while the curvature is negative. So the phenomenology depends very much on how big these coefficients are relative to each other and what sort of relations they may obey. I haven't been, to this point, confident enough about these coefficients to really say, oh, it's time to start fine-tuning. I've just done rough estimates and say, well, yeah, the percent level, you can arrange for inflation to occur. But I think once we're really sure about all the terms of the potential, then it would make a lot of sense to figure out, well, you know, what's the reasonable measure for these coefficients, and then what's the resulting measure for the tilt, et cetera. So one thing which I want, so in 1 minute, I will qualitatively say what happened, how these viewpoints are related. The last thing that I computed was the D3 brain drawn big because it's affecting the D7 brain, right? The D3 is the source of the problem, and the D7 brain feels the problem because its superpotentials is corrected. You could ask, I mean, what about Newton's third law, right? How can you use the D7 brains as the source and the D3 brain as the problem? And the answer to that is that indeed, non-perturbative effects on the D7 brains, drawn here big as the source some G-flux. That G-flux is the source here on the right-hand side of the phi minus equation inversion. And that, if you plug that in, that gives you the phi minus that I showed you. So this picture roughly tells you how the first calculation I did on the gravity side and the last calculation I did in N equals 1 for D supergravity are related with, namely, the D3 or the D7 can be the source for this calculation. So let me, I could write down a couple of things against that, but let me not go there. So let me conclude. We have a systematic approach to computing the structure of the potential in warped brain inflation. The method is to consider generic perturbations of the ultraviolet, which is focused on the most relevant terms, or in the CFD to consider the most relevant operators. The approach reproduces, extends, and simplifies the results of direct computation, which I showed you at the end, from matched D7 brains. And I think we captured totally general effects of compactification. But there is this important open issue, which is to figure out to what extent the coefficients, these CIs, can be determined in a given case. Now, the take-home lesson, I would say, from the viewpoint of moduli stabilization in D3 brain potentials, is that the leading effect at long distances for a D3 brain far away from a lot of moduli stabilizing stuff is that the D7 brain's source fluxes, imaginary anti-self dual fluxes, G minus, and that is how they talk. And then the phenomenology is inflection point. So in terms of future directions, in this model, well, what this model has been almost completely killed. I think killed not in the sense of not working, but in the sense of being beaten to death and having little interest left to do. And I think it's useful to do that in a couple more cases, to work through as many models as possible in enough detail to compute the potential a couple different ways to be really sure. Because one thing we have learned in the sad saga of computing this potential over and over again is that you get it wrong, or at least we got it wrong a couple times, and or at least one sees various terms but doesn't really know how big the given terms are, from what perspective you should understand them, things remain confusing. Finally, once you have it three ways, then you really know all the terms. So it would be nice to see models of inflation and string theory where you have so many computations of the potential that there can be no possible term. Thanks.
So what you're discussing here is a degree of knowledge, a degree of freedom, you get some relevant operator if you're doing these things. But what happens if you're actually not allowed to integrate out the degree of freedom because they're not sitting in there? So you're assuming you can integrate them out.
That's right. So what the most important subtlety with all of this is multi-field effects, right? The degrees of freedom associated to, let's say, the deformation of the tip of the throat or the overall volume that can't actually be integrated out. In that case, it would be interesting to understand if any aspect of the strategy is actually helpful there. I think the way that this would be useful is as a first step to say, well, the potential from arbitrary bulk stuff in a static approximation for the bulk stuff is such and such, and then one could use that to do a multi-field analysis of any fields that remain light. Now, in general, you know that most of the fields are not going to be light, because the volume might move and then the deformation of the tip might move. There are five other fields, the angular directions, which can properly be analyzed this way. That's not a problem at all. But certain remaining moduli cannot be integrated out. And for that, there's no great way that I know of dealing with those types of sitting.
Well, we have a great time now. So if you want to continue talking to Liam, we can just do that offline. We can reconvene at about 10:30 or so. Just thank Liam again.
Okay.